From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, it's Election Day. We'll see what changes in voter registration and no-reason absentee voting mean for voters and clerks. Plus, the rough welcome home for an African-American Vietnam veteran.
But then also, Black Americans were saying things like, oh, you went away to fight that white man's war. You're stupid. Why did you do that?
A new album from a West Michigan singer-songwriter who had big challenges in making new music.
He went to the physician, they had some tests done, and turned out he had, you know, a very shocking discovery that he had throat cancer.
And what are prisons for? We hear from State Corrections Director Heidi Washington.
The focus on the future, the focus on not letting the thing that you did define the rest of your life, and rather focusing on turning prison time into productive time.
Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Prisons are changing, and that means the way we view and treat offenders is also changing.
We are very focused in this department on education and employment. I think it's all of those things that we're working on before these men and women leave us and go back out into the world.
Later in today's program, a conversation with the director of the Michigan Department of Corrections, Heidi Washington, as we continue our week-long series, Life on the Inside. But first, the clock is ticking loudly for programs hit by Governor Gretchen Whitmer's budget cuts. The GOP-controlled legislature and the Democratic governor are in a showdown over the executive power she exerted in making nearly $1 billion in funding cuts to a wide variety of programs. And the State House and Senate will soon leave on their November hunting break, and they won't be back in Lansing till December 3rd. So just a few days remain to get funding restored for affected programs. The Michigan Education Corps is one of the programs. Executive Director Holly Windrum is with us. Holly, your group's helped thousands of kids improve their literacy and math skills since 2012 by putting helpers into schools for one-on-one help. And you got a Governor's Service Award in September, and then what?
Well, and then a couple weeks later, we were notified that our funding in the state school aid budget had been vetoed.
Boy, so you've lost all your state funding?
Yes, all of the funding. Now, that's not all of the funding that our program uses to support the thousands of students throughout the state, but it is about 60%. So we are in a crisis state right now.
Do you have any confidence, Holly, that you will get any or all of that funding back before the House and Senate break for the hunting break until early December?
Well, I firmly believe that the governor, as well as our legislators, are firmly committed to supporting education and, frankly, supporting all of the programs that were vetoed in the governor's budget. And I believe that if legislators can come back to the table, I firmly believe that we will see reinstatement of those funds. I think they know how critically important education is, especially right now in light of the third grade reading bill.
Yes, and let's talk a little about this is the year third graders could be held back if their reading skills don't meet the standard, and now what changes might you have to make if you don't have this funding?
Well, a number of our schools utilize our K-3 reading core model as a way of supporting students who are reading below grade level and providing them with evidence-based intervention in order to close their achievement gap in reading. So it aligns perfectly with what the requirements of the third grade reading bill ask districts to do. And that's what a number of our districts partner with us in order to provide. Without this funding, we're going to have to tell our districts that we are no longer going to be able to provide services to potentially thousands of kids.
Have you been able to speak with anyone in the governor's office or even the governor herself?
We have not personally been able to speak with anyone, but we know through conversations with staff in the governor's office, as well as other legislators, that there is wide support for our program, as well as many of the other programs that were cut. I know that they know the importance. They've seen the data. They know that our interventions are evidence-based, and they know the impact we're making for kids. I know that if they can just come to the table, and if they are willing to revisit the decisions that were made in the veto, take a look at the supplemental budget, and put us back in and make sure that we get fully funded, that we can get this accomplished.
You've got Republican legislative leaders, Senate Majority Leader Shirky, House Speaker Chatfield, and they're saying, we're not changing the schedule. We've got a budget in place.
You know, and that is certainly the position right now. However, I do know that there are a lot of individuals who are going to their legislators, including Shirky and Chatfield, to say the impact of the vetoes is significant, and it's putting significant services in a crisis state throughout the state of Michigan. My ask is to advocate strongly to say, please, we know we can't change the budget that has been accepted, but there is an opportunity for supplemental funding to be able to come back and help at least fill in most of the gap.
If this funding is not restored, let's take a long-term look. What's ahead for the Michigan Education Corps and for the students you work with?
Yeah, the outlook isn't good. So we are very fortunate that we have been really good stewards, and through the support of the Hope Network organization, we are able to continue programming to our schools through the remainder of this school year. And it's going to be tight. But we really felt strongly that it was, frankly, just wrong to pull needed services from kids out of schools if we could in any way prevent that. So we're going to continue. However, this is critical timing, because right now is when schools and our program, we're starting to talk about the next program year already. And schools need to make some decisions about what they're going to have in place to kick off the next school year in order to support their students. If we don't get the funding, then schools are going to have to look elsewhere at more costly intervention services to be able to provide to their students, which they have to do. It's required by the third grade reading law, in addition to just supporting students in general who are not meeting their reading and math grade level needs. It's not about waiting until next spring or waiting until, you know, we start talking about the next budget year. Really, right now is the time that we need legislators to put us back in that supplemental budget and get that supplemental budget passed.
Holly Windrum, Executive Director of the Michigan Education Corps. Holly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now we turn to this Election Day 2019, the first general election since Michigan voters approved no-reason absentee voting and automatic voter registration. We check in now with Fred Miller, Macomb County Clerk. Fred, how's Election Day proceeding in Macomb County? How's voter turnout doing?
Well, it's still too early to tell, but, you know, the weather is cooperating. It's a brisk, cool day as we can usually expect in Michigan in November, but it certainly seems like voters are coming out to make their voices heard.
Do you think making it easier for people to vote absentee and having automatic voter registration, do you think it's affected voter participation at all?
Well, with only three relatively lower turnout elections this year, in May, in August, and then today's general election for cities, we have a small data set to work from, so we really don't know how it's ultimately going to work out for, say, a high volume turnout election like next November's presidential election. But what we do know is that people are starting to get the word about the change in voter registration deadlines and in shifting their behavior from voting at the polls to voting for absentee or vote at home. Voting by mail. So what's not clear is if there are people who are already going to vote at the polls are now voting absentee, or if it's a new set of voters. I think it's going to take a couple of elections before we really understand if it's changing the driving a higher turnout. But one thing's for sure, it makes it easier for voters. All of us as voters have more options, more tools in our toolbox to be able to make our voices heard on any of these elections.
Well, I know we dropped our ballots off at our city clerk's office over the weekend, like we were allowed to do. I'm wondering, have you gotten more absentee ballots this year? Are you noticing an uptick in that?
Absolutely. All three of our elections this year, we've seen a significant increase in the number of people, number of voters voting by mail, voting absentee. Mm-hmm. But it remains to be seen if that's a higher turnout or if it's just a shift in voting. But it has been significant. In some of our city elections in August, Typically, you'd see 30% of the people voting absentee and 70% of the people voting at the polls. And we saw in some of the cities across Macomb County, that was actually flipped, where we had 70% of the people voting absentee and 30% of the voting at the polls. So it's been a huge shift. But, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done by clerks and elections officials across the state of Michigan, because we know that good voters aren't born that way. Bad voters aren't born that way. We have to educate people about these habits. You know, voting is a learned habit, and so we really have to, you know, spread the message of these new rights for Michigan voters. Early voting on Saturdays, as you mentioned, and no reason absentee voting, and the changing voter registration deadline.
You're a former state lawmaker, Fred. Are there any policy changes that you think need to be addressed with elections now that you're getting the view from the clerk's perspective as well?
Well, I will say this. You know, there's a lot of discussion in the clerk community about with this change to increased volume of absentee voters, it does put a tremendous strain on the local clerks who have to tabulate, who have to rely on elections inspectors, people that they recruit to help them count the ballots and do the tallying. And it is a tremendous strain. It makes for a long day. And people have to be very precise after they've worked a very long day. And so I think there is concern about that. But I got to say that since I've gotten to know more clerks, both Republicans and Democrats, everybody is committed to making sure that the promise of Proposal 3 as adopted by voters is fully realized. It's just a matter of maybe getting some additional resources to make sure that we are able to perform that as well as we possibly can under this additional kind of workload. It's gonna take some resources, and maybe it'll take adjusting some expectations. And so instead of people, you know, having the expectation of getting instantaneous results, maybe we have to wait a little bit longer to tally longer, or maybe it's, as some clerks have said, to start preparing those ballots for tabulation earlier. But that's going to have to be a policy decision that will be weighed by the legislature.
A final few moments here. Fred, Macomb County certainly played a big role in the 2016 presidential election as a national bellwether. What are your thoughts about Macomb County taking America's political temperature going into the big one in 2020?
I think there's a lot of interest. And again, it's something that that Prop 3 is going to help with. I think we remember reading stories and hearing reports about long lines at polling locations, and I think that there's going to be as much interest in the 2020 presidential election as any election we can remember. And so I think that increased absentee voting will help reduce lines and really make it easier for people to have their voices heard in this crucial election. And I think there's a lot of interest in. And, you know, it's going to be interesting. The more I learn, also, I will say that Michigan has a very decentralized election.
We'll have to leave it there, Macomb County Clerk Fred Miller. Thanks for being with us. And we have much more ahead for you on Stateside. Thank you. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time to check out some of the latest music coming out of West Michigan. With us again is John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com. And John, you found artists this month with really compelling stories in one way or another. And we're starting with Holland native and Grand Rapids-based singer-songwriter John Sanger, a longtime presence on the music scene in West Michigan, isn't he?
Yeah, he's been performing around here for more than 20 years, and he's been recording albums as well. But it's interesting that early this year, after a couple of gigs, he started feeling a little scratchiness in his throat. He went to the physician, they had some tests done, and turned out he had, you know, a very shocking discovery that he had throat cancer. And that really put him on the sidelines for several months. He had to have chemo and radiation treatments, and he was forced to the sidelines. And during that time, he had already started writing a new album, which he calls the Sanger Family Album. And he said that going through this cancer treatment really gave him an amazing sense of perspective. You know, it was an amazing process for him to be writing some of this music as he was going through this illness. And it's about his family, and it's about life's trials and tribulations, and it really is a case of life imitating fiction, and he really features some truly heartrending material.
Well, let us listen to a sampling of a track from this new album from John Sanger. This track is Defective.
All alone at recess, staring at the other kids. Teens are getting picky. Out here on the
So his singing, John, has not been affected by that throat cancer.
No, I think he was very fortunate in that, and I think they caught it at the right time, and he's back out performing, and he really, I think, is embracing this sort of new life that he's leading. He said that he's not going to gig quite as much as he used to. He spent way too much time on the road and away from his family, and he said he's going to try to cut back a little bit more and spend more time with family and friends as a result of this. But I really think that some of the music that he put on this particular release is probably the most interesting and intriguing and powerful of his entire career.
He's still got a few gigs coming up, doesn't he?
He does indeed. He'll be playing at Bostwick Lake Inn, which is north of Grand Rapids here, on November 15th. And then he plays Iron Well in Grand Rapids on November 24th.
Okay. Now, John Sinkevich, you might not know this, but I just came back from a couple of weeks in Virginia and North Carolina and Kentucky. And one of the highlights was spending a glorious day at the Blue Ridge Folklife Festival in Renham, Virginia. And I heard some incredible old-time mountain music. And I have to say, this next Michigan artist would fit right into that wonderful scene. And of course, I'm talking about Laurel Primo.
She was very much impacted by that kind of music, exactly. Laurel Primo is part of the duo called Red Tail Ring, which is an award-winning indie folk act that really focuses a lot on meshing sort of traditional folk music with contemporary music, and with a lot of harmonies and some really beautiful sort of insightful songs. But this time around, as part of her solo project, she focused on an all-instrumental thing that really focuses on fiddle music. And on this project, she also got some help from guitarist Owen Marshall and from Joshua Davis and from fiddler Aaron Jonah Lewis. And she takes this old-timey sound and flavors it in kind of contemporary fashion. And she kind of puts it that there's these harmonic drones, there's minimalist repetition, there's these rich polyrhythms. And from my perspective, it's incredibly haunting stuff. It's one of those things that would make a perfect soundtrack if you're riding up north to look at the colors during this time of year, because things get to be a little more melancholy in the fall. And I think this is a perfect soundtrack for that.
You know, I can totally see people up on a dance floor clogging or flatfoot dancing to this music, just like I saw the other day in Renham. Where can people catch the Laurel Primo Trio and actually Red Tail Ring while we're talking about it?
Yeah, both bands are really incredible. The Laurel Primo Trio plays the Sandbox Listening Room in Kalamazoo on December 6th, the Yurt at the Little Fleet in Traverse City on December 7th, and then the second Sunday folk dance, as you were talking about dancing, in Crystal Falls, Michigan, if you want to head up north, on December 8th. And then Red Tail Ring, by the way, will play the Michigan Academy of Folk Music in Holland on November 14th.
And now we turn to someone making her mark on modern country music. Who's that?
That's Sadie Bass, and it's interesting because she's really made a splash over the last couple of years because she's been opening for a lot of big-name country artists here in Michigan.
Old faded jeans, holes in the knees, Gramps says I'm grinding his gears. Those new hats, you can take them back, I've had this one for years.
She's played a number of big country festivals like Summer Jam, Country Boots and Bands, the B93 Birthday Bash here in Grand Rapids. And it's interesting because she actually gave up a softball scholarship and she dropped out of college because she decided she wanted to be in music as part of her career. And I think that decision is paying off because she's really gotten a lot of attention with her band. She recently won an online fan-based contest to play superstar Brantley Gilbert's Kick It in the Ship cruise, which sets sail for Miami this Monday. And there are a whole bunch of other stars on this cruise. So she's going to be rubbing elbows with some pretty big names like Chase Rice, Lanco, Diamond Rio, and John Langston. And as a matter of fact, she opened for John Langston here in Grand Rapids about a week ago. She also played a pre-party in Miami for this cruise, and she'll play twice on the cruise this week. She's only 23 years old. Her band features musicians from Holland, Lansing, Jackson, Homer, and Marshall. And she released the single Wear It Out earlier this year.
Tells a story. Reminds us who we are, but nothing's good until you wear it out, rub it up, break it up, or see where it's been, let it ache, feel the fade, wash off the new.
That is good. I love country music. I'm going to tell you, I want to hear more of Sadie Bass. So when are we going to expect an EP or an album? Better yet.
Yeah, she plans to release an EP next spring. She's working with Smokin' Sled Dog Records to book a bunch of shows nationally as well as around here next year. So I think all country fans, especially those in Michigan that have been following her for the last few years, are really going to be paying attention to where she ends up because they really appreciate this down-to-earth. She's a small-town girl. She grew up hunting and fishing with her dad, and she's really got that authentic country flavor about her. So I think she's definitely an artist to keep an eye on.
Well, great choices this month, John Sinkovich. Many thanks. And as always, you can find out more about these and other West Michigan musicians by going to localspins.com. John, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. With Veterans Day right around the corner, we put extra focus on our service members, our veterans. One special event's happening tomorrow night in Ann Arbor. Michigan vets on stage sharing their stories from World War II, Vietnam, Desert Storm, Iraq, and more. One of the veterans is here with us now. Tyrone Chapman served in the Vietnam War after joining the Army in Detroit when he was 17 years old. These days, he's the CEO of the Michigan Veterans Foundation in Detroit. Tyrone, welcome.
It's great to be with you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Tyrone, take us back to 1972. You come home to Detroit from serving in Vietnam. What was your experience like?
Well, it wasn't a very pleasant one. Certainly being greeted at the airport, having arrived back home, you know, being protested against and being called names and people saying things that, you know, didn't make me feel very good, shell shock. Boozers, you guys lost the war when nothing could be further from the truth. We didn't lose that war. And when I came home to the city of Detroit in August, it was extremely hot. And the only thing I wanted to do is get out of that airport and get home to my family.
It's such a different welcome than the vets of World War II and Korea got.
Yeah, it was less than a hero's welcome. Of course, it was an unpopular war. And there was a lot of turbulence that was taking place you know, in America at the time, a lot of civil unrest, et cetera. And I guess for the most part, people had to place the blame on someone. So they figured we may as well place it on those guys who were over there fighting. So.
And Tyrone, how is the African-American Vietnam vet experience different from that of your white brothers and sisters who served in Vietnam?
Well, I grew up on the east side of Detroit in poverty, so among drugs, et cetera. So joining the military was my way of getting out. But getting into the military and us realizing that we're all brothers of the same cloth, we were just fine with that because we knew we all bled the same color. But for me as an African-American coming home, not just to some of the racist things that were being said to me by white Americans, but then also black Americans were saying things like, oh, you went away to fight that white man's war. You're stupid. Why did you do that? Which in some cases led to a couple bar fights. And so, yeah, it wasn't a pleasant experience on either side of the fence with regard to that.
And now you serve as head of the Michigan Veterans Foundation. What is the mission of this group?
Well, our mission is to take care of those who've taken care of this great nation. It's very simple. We help those veterans who need to regain their stability, either from post-traumatic stress disorder, combat-related stress, in some cases, chronic homelessness, substance abuse, alcoholism. And, you know, we have a facility in Detroit called the Pentagon. We have approximately 104 veterans who are under our care. They're here for 18 months, and we sometimes say it's not just a job here, it's an adventure. So it's not the pretty side, but to me it's the most profound side because I get to interact with some of these guys who served in some of the places that most people are familiar with, and not just Vietnam, but Desert Shield, Desert Calm, Desert Storm, Grenada, Lebanon, and everything in between. So I'm just very fortunate to be in the position that I am in to share with other veterans that, you know, there's life after, and we struggled, but most of us are rocking and rolling today. We're the voice for those who won't have an opportunity to share some of what I'm able to share with you and your audience today.
What are the veterans that you're working with, what do they most need?
Well, For the most part, they need a place where they can come in and just kind of stand down, as we say, settle down, and know that they're here among their brother veterans, and there's that spirit of camaraderie that exists. So they need everything from housing to gainful employment, immediate access to the VA healthcare system. And in my opinion, it seems that we ought to be first in line for those things, housing, jobs, healthcare, et cetera. So we are in a position where we watch these veterans basically pull themselves up from the abyss of problems and get back out into society as a positive, productive citizen. So here we offer everything from healthcare through Eastern Michigan University, legal through University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. We have a vet rescue program for those veterans who are chronically homeless, who you may typically see on the street corners, panhandling. We think that's a national disgrace for anyone who served this nation to be out there and having to resort to that. So we provide a safe, secure environment for them to collect their thoughts, regain their stability, experience what it's like to be in this environment, and then we watch them excel and move forward from there.
Tyrone, tell us the story of how you wound up becoming the CEO of the Michigan Veterans Foundation.
Oh, it was a long, dusty road. Actually, I'm a licensed social worker, so my background is working with homeless folk. I started out in the Cass Corridor, which is now known as Midtown, doing street outreach from 3 a.m. until 6 a.m. in the morning. We were basically going out looking for the old street people and offering a safe haven of sorts. We call it the Public Inebriate Program. So I did that up until 1998. I crossed paths with another Vietnam veteran in 1995 when Detroit was putting together a project called A Home for Every Detroiter. And I met a wonderful individual, Toby Geibick, who was 4th Infantry Division. And we just clicked from there. I took a seat on the board because the organization had went under. We brought the organization back, petitioned housing and urban development, got some brick and mortar dollars, and we built our first facility on Park Avenue, 2770 Park Ave. And as we got closer to opening our doors, I sent some of my key staff over to help Toby get this thing up and running. I spent a great deal of time there and got so excited about it, I resigned from Neighborhood Service Organization and took a job at the foundation in those days as the Associate Executive Director.
And how did you come to become the Executive Director?
Unfortunately, Toby Geibick was still haunted by some of the demons from the war. I'll say it like that. You know, the intrusive thoughts and the like, and committed suicide. And so I was thrust in that position. I had no idea where he had left off with anything. So I spent a great deal of time in his office just trying to get a handle on things. And ultimately, I was able to do that because I did come from a social work background and having run nonprofits in the past. So
you picked up the torch.
Yeah, I picked up that torch, and we like to think that, you know, we're a whole new and exciting organization now because we've really created a multi-service system where it's kind of like one-stop shopping. If we can't get her done, I can't think of any other group that can. So we're a program for veterans run by veterans, and I think that means a lot because some of the vets look up to me as their hero and say, hey, I get a little choked up here. Chapman's a Vietnam veteran, and he's one of us, and, you know, look what he's doing. So it's amazing.
And you're going to be among the vets sharing stories tomorrow evening at Fisher House, Michigan's Stories of Service. These are vets ranging from World War II up to present day, talking about their service. And it will be Wednesday the 6th at the Michigan Theater from 7 to 9 in downtown Ann Arbor. You can get tickets at the door, although there is no charge for veterans or service members. But it's important to note that all proceeds benefit Fisher House, Michigan, which wants to provide a home away from home where military and vet families can stay at no cost while someone they love is getting treated at the VA hospital. So it's certainly, I'm sure, a cause very near and dear to your heart, Tyrone Chapman.
Absolutely, it is. And I'm so looking forward to it. I've you know, there's a wave of patriotism now that exists, and I'm most appreciative of it. And to me, it's extremely appropriate and long overdue. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, Tyrone Chapman, thank you for what you did in Vietnam and what you've been doing for veterans in Michigan since you became involved and now the CEO of the Michigan Veterans Foundation. It was great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate the opportunity. So have a great day.
After the break, what are prisons for? We'll hear from State Corrections Director Heidi Washington.
The focus on the future, the focus on not letting the thing that you did define the rest of your life, and rather focusing on turning prison time into productive time.
More from our series Life on the Inside. That is after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some see incarceration as punishment, even vengeance. Others see it as a means to keep the public safe. More recently, prisons have become an opportunity for rehabilitation. Today, as we continue our series Life on the Inside, we find out what Heidi Washington thinks. She's spent her career working for the Michigan Department of Corrections and became its director in 2015, Stateside host Lester Graham sat down with Director Washington to get her thoughts on just what prisons are for.
This is going to be a wide-ranging kind of philosophical conversation, so let's start with some fundamentals. What is the purpose of a prison?
Well, I think the purpose of the prison is obviously to provide public safety and to keep people who have harmed society separate from society. So I think that's historically what the purpose of prison has been. But I think we're evolving and we're expanding what prison is all about.
Well, what's your driving philosophy on what a correction system or a prison should be?
Well, you know, the Michigan Department of Corrections is here to provide public safety to the citizens of Michigan. And we do that in the short term by incarcerating people and by supervising individuals on probation and parole. But what we're really after in Michigan is long-term public safety, and how do we create long-term public safety? And, you know, that's the real challenge, and we want that to be productive time. We want it to end up being time that is transformative and where when people leave and go out into the world, we can create long-term public safety because we've equipped them with what they need to be successful in the world.
What do you mean by that? What do you do for them that allows them to get to that point?
Well, you know, a number of things. We are focused on delivering programs that are based in evidence, that are geared towards their areas of particular risk and need. We are very focused in this department on education and employment and teaching and training. And so I think it's all of those things that we're working on before these men and women leave us and go back out into the world.
We talked to a lot of inmates, and some of them have been there decades, a lot longer than you or any other staff member at DOC. In what way would a prisoner who'd been there for 30 years be treated or have opportunities that he or she wouldn't have had 30 years ago?
Well, again, in my 23 years in the department, we've evolved and are doing things much differently. For people that you've spoken to who have been here for that number of years, I'm sure they'll tell you a lot's different. The investment in education, the investment in programming, I hope the training of our staff and the interactions that they have with staff, you know, the focus on the future, the focus on not letting the thing that you did define the rest of your life, and rather focusing on turning prison time into productive time. You know, another big change is the way society views this. We're in a time right now where criminal justice reform and the idea of hiring returning citizens, of bringing people back into the community, of providing the necessary supports to them.
You have been talking about keeping the public safe from somebody who might do them harm. You've talked about rehabilitation of a fashion. Another thing that the public often considers jail to be or prison to be is punishment. How do you balance rehabilitation versus punishment?
Sure. Well, I mean, people come to prison as punishment for the crime that they commit, but they don't come to prison for punishment. And so, once they get here, I think it is our job to, of course, ensure that the sentence that the court handed down, that they serve that time. But again, that we look at this environment as a productive environment. And, you know, more and more in this country and certainly in this state and across the nation, we're looking at humanizing prison. And we need to look at every individual as a human being. And so that's part of, you know, what we're doing and part of what we do in these programs.
We've been talking about making sure that inmates have some kind of job skills and other personal skills that they need to go back into society. But if someone is sentenced to life in prison, or their sentence is so long it's essentially life in prison, what role would rehabilitation have in their lives?
Well, I'm sure that you had the opportunity to speak to some of those people on your visit. And I think it's important for all of us to have the opportunity to grow and to develop and to give back, no matter what our environment is. And so the reality is that for many men and women, their environment is going to be prison. And it's important to, you know, be successful and to have the confidence and the tools that you need to be successful in that environment. Of course, because our resources are limited, there are, you know, not as many opportunities for people in that circumstance. But that's one of the things that our strategic plan focuses on, is ways that we can expand those types of opportunities for that population.
Yeah, among the lifers, there was a lot of talk about self-worth and contributing to society. And
right. That
at Lakeland Correctional Center, that's done because they have these large gardens and they give this produce to the city of Coldwater, which I thought was really interesting. What's the best way for Michigan to further reduce recidivism, to stop release offenders from returning to prison? I saw that your recidivism rate has been going down.
Right. So the recidivism rate, which is the measurement at which individuals return to prison after 3 years, in Michigan, it's roughly about 29%. And we've made great strides in that, from a high of well over 50% several years ago. So how do we continue to work at that? Well, you know, again, I think it's continuing to find opportunities for self-growth, for employment, for education, for proper role modeling, all of those types of things. There's studies out there that demonstrate that money spent on education, you know, it works. And we're demonstrating that through our education programs in Michigan, through our partnership with Jackson College and Mott and Delta and Calvin, as well as with the Vocational Village, where, you know, we've had about 700 men leave the program and less than 15 have returned to prison, which is pretty remarkable.
Do you believe that the lawmakers in Lansing, the most of them anyway, understand and support your vision of what correction systems should look like?
I think we've been very fortunate to have a number of our legislative partners take the time to come and tour facilities. We've had actual hearings at prisons this time around, which is something different. I don't recall in my entire career that we've ever had a legislative hearing at one of our prisons. So I think there is a great interest in what we're doing. And, you know, I think we're definitely headed in the right direction.
How do you persuade a skeptical lawmaker who might only be interested in making sure bad people are locked up?
I would say, and I've said this, look, we can't afford not to do this. We're spending $2 billion in this state running the Department of Corrections, and certainly billions more across this country, and not getting outcomes that we'd like to see. And so investing in the kinds of things that we're doing is helping us to get better outcomes. And, you know, when I talk about better outcomes, I'm, you know, of course, talking about, you know, the cost of incarceration. But the costs that can't be measured are far greater than that. And that's the cost to our communities, to our families, to the children of these individuals. And those are costs that we need to be looking at, because we want to stop this process as early in somebody's life as possible, right? So that's one of the reasons why I've been focusing on the front end of the system on probation so much, is to try to have early interventions with people at their earliest intersection with the criminal justice system, so we can get them on the right track before they experience the negative repercussions of incarceration and before their families are harmed by that as well. And so there are a lot of consequences to this. And, you know, I think that people are paying attention, and I think that Michigan's on the right track.
You mentioned $2 billion a year. The Department of Corrections eats up a huge portion of the state budget. Dollars are tight. Prisons are understaffed. Many corrections officers are forced to work double shifts for days at a time. That's mandatory overtime. That's a morale killer. What can be done about that?
Right. Well, you know, we are very focused. It's in our strategic plan on wellness within the Department of Corrections, acknowledging that this is a tough environment sometimes to work in, and it does take its toll.
Let me stop you there, because you're talking about working with the symptoms. How about the cause? And that's that mandatory overtime.
Right. Well, that is, you know, one of the issues. And we have a very heavy emphasis on recruiting in the department. We have been running quarterly academies. Just this week, I was up in the UP speaking to a new academy that started there. And we will start an academy down here with another 185 recruits. And so, you know, we will continue to put heavy emphasis on recruitment, but we need to also work on retention. And when I talk about employee wellness, I think that is part of it as well. And so investing in our employees, giving them the tools and resources they need to deal with the stress that comes along with this job. And, you know, I think that that's also important when we talk about the environment, the prison environment. And one of the things that I would really like to start to measure is the environment that is created when you have something like the vocational village, a productive, pro-social, pro-learning environment, and to be able to study the effects of that on the prison culture. Because when you come to a place like that, it's a positive place. And we've seen it through these last few years that prisoners don't engage in misconducts. There aren't grievances. It's a completely different feel. And that creates a more positive working environment for staff, less stress, and, you know, less people taking time off and those sorts of things. So that's part of what I would like us to be studying in the whole realm of retention and employee wellness in the future.
Why is it so hard to retain and recruit people for the jobs?
Well, I mean, for one thing, you know, the economy is doing great right now. It's booming, and there's a lot of opportunities for jobs. I think law enforcement across the board is struggling with recruitment, and so we're no different. You know, I think we need to continue to educate people about why this is a great place to work and about the opportunity to, you know, have a meaningful, long-lasting career that is truly, you know, impacting people's lives. But again, it is, you know, it's not for everybody. And sometimes the hours are long and, you know, there are things that happen that we have to deal with that you're just not going to have to face in other career choices that you might make.
And right. So, yeah. And I wanted to get to that, because you keep talking about wellness, but, you know, the overtime, you know, they're missing their kids' games, they're missing holidays, and then the stress, they see violence in a way that many of us can't imagine, and they can't really talk to family about that. So who can they talk to? Is this wellness program giving them a chance to I don't know, talk out their issues, their problems?
Right. So the wellness program, which we just created and launched, which, by the way, was the result of a cross-section team of staff that I put together from all across the department. I said to them, you know, we need to focus on wellness. We need to invest in wellness. And I want you guys to get together and think about ways that we can do that. What would the ideal program look like? And how could we implement something in this department? What would it take? They came back to me with a proposal for the creation of a wellness unit with 5 staff that would staff it. 4 of them are clinician level staff and 1 chaplain. I accepted their proposal, and we have invested in that, and we have created it. And it is a 24-hour-a-day, 7 days a week opportunity for staff and their family members and retirees to access these clinicians. They've hit the ground running. They are all over the state responding to incidents, responding to requests for assistance, and they've got, you know, a lot of work ahead of them, but I can tell you that they have already made a tremendous impact on this department. We'll have a peer support network stretching across the entire department from the field to the prisons, and we'll have specially trained peer supports that are on site to be able to assist people as well. I'm not sure, and I don't know of any other department yet in the country that is investing the type of resources that we are on wellness.
As we've already mentioned, stateside visited Lakeland Correctional Center in Coldwater. And when I mean a lot of reporters and photographers, first of all, thanks for letting us in. We appreciate that. We were repeatedly told by staff and inmates that Lakeland was one of the best, if not the best, prison in Michigan. And I can understand why you would send us to the best. But how does it compare to a typical Michigan prison?
First of all, I'm thrilled to hear, you know, that staff and prisoners alike said that their facility was the best, because that tells me that they take pride in it. And I think that's really important. And again, there's a lot of great things going on there, the contributions that they make to the community, the dedication of the staff. And I think that if you came to the Parnell Correctional Facility in Jackson, where I just spent the day, they'd tell you the same thing. And I could replicate that over and over.
Lakeland is a little different, we should say. It has a high number of lifers. I think 44% of the population there are serving life sentences. It has a large geriatric population. A lot of those are lifers. How does Lakeland fit into the correction system landscape?
Yeah, well, you kind of just explained it a little bit. Lakeland's niche, when I think about Lakeland, is they have that special wing for geriatric prisoners. So they have developed, I think, a good system for working with that special population. And so we actually started initially developing the prisoner care aides down at Lakeland because of that population, where we actually have some prisoners and a lot of them lifers that have the opportunity to assist with some of the more frail prisoners and help them with some of their activities of daily living and help them get around and all of those types of things. So again, going back to your prior comments, it gives them a sense of community. It gives them a purpose. They're able to help and give something back right there at their own facility.
We wanted to ask you one more question and get your thoughts on a question that we asked a lot of inmates at Lakeland Correctional Center. And we put it like this. A lot of people think that anyone who's in prison must deserve to be there. So why should they care what happens in there? So why should people care about what happens inside our prisons?
Well, they should, because we're all human beings. And regardless of what people did in the world to land themselves in prison, 95% of them are coming home, and we want to treat people in a humane manner, and we want to help them, you know, with the issues that they're having, with their mental health issues, with their anger management issues, their education, with whatever their needs are, so that when they come out and they come and live in our community, that they can be productive members of society. So we absolutely should care what happens to them in prison. We should care how the prison is run, and we should care what's happening, you know, with our tax dollars there.
Heidi Washington is the director of the Michigan Department of Corrections. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow in our series, Life on the Inside, we'll hear from two inmates at Lakeland Correctional Facility in Coldwater. Both have sentences that will likely keep them in prison until the 2030s.
Well, I set small goals throughout the day. I have a hard time looking at years to do. It's much easier to just make it to lunch, and then just make it through the afternoon, and then just make it to dinner.
Thing is, every day when I wake up in the morning, I start my day off and say, I'm going to make some type of progress. When I see myself on the outside, you know, I see a man in a suit and tie.
For an exclusive look inside Lakeland Correctional Facility, just go to lakeland.michiganradio.org for revealing black and white photos of the people who work there and who call it home. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.